Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
David, I put it to you that there's a point in life when you're too old for biopics.
Oh, yes.
And I think I might have reached that point. I just noticed that Jeremy Allen's playing Springsteen in the new biopic about Nebraska. And Timothy Chalamet is playing...
Easy for you to say.
Circa, the new Newport Festival. There's pictures of him all over the place this week, walking through New York in shades and a kind of suede jacket.
Supposed to be Bob Dylan.
Yeah, and those are obviously, I mean, I understand that. They're aimed at people who don't know much about Dylan and don't know much about Springsteen and do know a lot about the people who are starring in them and will probably go and see them. But my feeling is what you're getting from biopics mostly is information. And if you're sufficiently interested in a biopic to be watching it in the first place, you probably know most of that information. And therefore, there's not much percentage in doing it. And I'm too old to be convinced that somebody is playing the part of someone I'm really familiar with. And also, I think that Get Back has changed my view of rock films. I'm sorry, it has. I know it's a completely different kind of film, but Get Back is about creative process, and its level of revelation was absolutely enormous, and it's about the internal dynamic of the group, you know, and it's about songwriting. And the amount that I learned from that was so fantastic. That seeing somebody... Having said that, you and I went to see Elvis, the Baz Luhrmann Elvis, didn't we, 2 or 3 years ago? Mm-hmm. It was very good.
Mm-hmm.
But just had really good live sequences, and Tom Hanks was really good as Tom Parker, and I don't know. What do you think? Are you too old for biopics?
Well, it's certainly the case that if they're making a film about Bruce Springsteen during the making of Nebraska, which is an extraordinary thing to focus on, really, and if they're making a film about Bob Dylan, what you'd say, around the time...
It's around Newport, isn't it?
Newport Festival. It's very specific, isn't it?
It is.
They're obviously hoping that the people who flock to the cinema will be people who have only the foggiest notion, really, of who Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan are or were. And there's no reason why they should, really. You know, that's obviously part of the reason for doing these things is to kind of keep these keep the interest in these performers alive and their catalogue and so forth. And it's also quite interesting, isn't it, that it does indicate a kind of feeling within entertainment that if you want grand figures, slightly larger than life figures, you have to go back quite a long way to get them, don't you?
Yeah,
really?
You do.
You know, nobody's doing that about, I don't know, nobody's doing that about anything that happened in the last 20 years. Nobody's doing that about Ed Sheeran, aren't they? You know, whereas back in the day, the Tommy Steele story used to be an Honor Your Cinema at the same time as Tommy Steele was still a kind of pop star. You know what I mean? That's the way it happened. It doesn't happen in that way any longer. So, you know, they won't be relying on you or me going along to the multiplex to watch those films. You know, they've been relying on a completely new generation. I suppose this is what happens now. You know, when people pass away, the reality of them passes away, And the image just takes over, doesn't it? You know, and that posterity, the future, will decide on a version of Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan or Marvin Gaye or Bob Marley or anybody you like to suggest. They will arrive at a version that appeals to them, that works in their worldview, that absolutely fits in.
Like Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, which is kind of slightly woke Elvis, isn't it?
The actual reality of them won't matter at all, you know, because they're kind of, their image in the end is, it's kind of more enduring than the reality of them, really.
Yeah.
They pass into myth. Actually, as an aside, I've had something on my phone. I wrote this down ages ago. I make a note on my phone of little quotes. And I've been meaning, I was looking at them last night. And I went down and I thought, God, I've been meaning to tell Mark that for absolutely ages. And I haven't got round to it, but I'm going to tell it to you now.
Go on, what was it?
This is a quote from Artie Shaw, the great 40s band leader, who worked with Sinatra and Bing Crosby and all sorts. And Bing Crosby was, you know, his image throughout his entire career was as this super relaxed individual who could reach a state of extraordinary serenity in the middle of the maddest action. You know, the thing about Bing was he was madly relaxed. And Artie Shaw said, Bing is no more Bing than Bogart was Bogart. I thought that was
very good.
Yeah, that all these people...
It's a huge act.
It's an act.
Beneath the calm exterior of the swan, there are a pair of feet frantically paddling.
And Bing, no less than anybody, by God, he worked at things. You know, all these people, they work at things like crazy. And it's, you know, what remains on the surface is the thing that's remembered. I think I sent you this morning, didn't I? I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. There's a terrific old documentary that's on the BBC iPlayer at the moment.
About Eric and Ernie.
Eric and Ernie rehearsing.
I just saw the first 10 minutes. That's right, because it was Eric's widow died.
She died this week at the age of 97.
Yeah.
So she had 40 years widowed, you know, which is extraordinary. But yes, the clip them rehearsing, I think in 1973, they're turning up at a BBC rehearsal studio. Both in their Rolls Royces. Did you know?
You know, that's what I thought was interesting.
That,
you know, when we were kids, a Rolls Royce was universally applauded.
Absolutely.
You know, the cover of Best of Sellers by Peter Sellers, he's buffing up, isn't he?
Absolutely. The
hood ornament of his Rolls Royce.
It was good on you.
When John Lennon bought a Rolls Royce and had it painted psychedelically, you know, he thought fantastic. Anybody in a Rolls Royce, you just applauded. And then it was very working class thing to have a Rolls Royce. Yes, I've made money and all that. It was fantastic. It's funny how now you saw a Rolls Royce, it would kind of, your hackles would rise. You know what I mean? There's something now that would just annoy you. It was just grotesquely
vulgar,
ostentatious and vulgar and
using the planet's resources. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny how that's totally changed.
It's totally changed. Anyway, the thing about Eric and Ernie was how much they rehearsed. There they are rehearsing a 1973 Christmas special. And the amount of work, I mean, I think at one point the producer said, well, we're pretty ahead of ourselves, actually. I think everybody should take a day off tomorrow. We don't need to be here. But Eric and Ernie still came in.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
And their attention to details a bit really early on where they're reading out original script and one of the producers says, and the church bell strikes four times. And they both go, twice. Twice is enough. Be too long for, you know, their detail, what they understood about timing and pacing and everything. It's incredible.
But it was all the result of massive amounts of work, you know. So, you know, the idea of that magic, you know, could only exist if they really, really worked at it in order to convince themselves that it was kind of going to be all right. You know, work was their insurance against it going wrong. You know, it's the old, I don't know, is it Gary Player, the golfer? You know, the harder I practice, the luckier I get, you know.
Or
that kind of thing. It's all work, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how we got onto that, but we're talking about Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan and the film, these films being made about certain points in their life. I note also, it's 30 years ago today, 32 years ago today, since the release, the curious release of two Bruce Springsteen albums on the same day, Human Touch and Lucky Town. And I remember, it's quite funny actually, the fuss that record companies traditionally make about embargoes and release dates and security. I had to review it for Q. The only way to get to hear it, and I was very fortunate to get to hear it, I don't think most people did, was to go to, it wasn't even to go to CBS offices, it was to go to CBS studios.
Yeah, maximum security studio, where you'd be frisked for recording devices.
In Whitfield Street, in, where it's just off Tottenham Road around there. And they had cleared, obviously the studio wasn't in use, but anyway, I was conducted into this. It was a big old studio, big enough for you to be able to record an orchestra in there. You used to use it for a lot of soundtrack work. And I was put in the control room, standing over this really space-age desk, you know, I don't know, 32 tracks or whatever. And there I was, I'm there on my own. And the guy puts in a tape, a DAT, you know, digital audio tape, which is the way that they used to circulate those things in the days before the internet and so forth, and put it in. And he said, well, I'll leave you now. And he went out. And I just pressed it to start. And I was listening to it. Huge, great speakers, massive, great speakers. And I was listening to it. And I thought, you know, this doesn't sound quite right. But I'm on my own. So I'm on my own.
Flicking little switches.
Hold on a second, Mark. Hold on a second. I've got, no exaggeration, 10,000 buttons are in front of me.
Yeah.
And faders and whatever. And I just, look, I'm no engineer at all. But I notice one, a little one just in front of me. And I thought, I'm just going to try that.
What's the worst that could happen?
What's the worst going to
happen? I erased.
I'm not going to mangle the tape or whatever. Anyway, and I pressed it, and suddenly it sounded fine. And do you know what the button was? Mono to stereo.
No.
Yes.
No.
They
slackable offence that the guy hadn't sorted that out for you.
Hadn't checked it at all, you know. And so I had to sit there, and I think I might have listened to it three times or something like that, and I had to write something really quickly. So he listened to two albums three times. I had to write something really quickly. And I was more favourable about them than I should have been. But, you know, that's just in the nature of reviewing. You know, if you're, and I was thinking about this week, reading those reviews of Beyoncé's album.
Oh, yeah. Neil McCormack in the Telegraph was complaining about how he'd had to be up all night. Up all night listening to this and writing this for you, dear readers. But it was a pleasure because it's a wonderful record.
And I read that and I thought, Neil, fair enough. I know you have your job to do and all that kind of stuff. But that cannot be a trustworthy judgment. If somebody has sat up all night and written it in a hurry, it can't be. You know, because what you tend to do is you come down on one side or the other. You know,
quite early on, actually. Early on, then you're looking for ammunition to support.
Of course you are.
Oh, great, another terrible track. Or another great track.
You know. Absolutely.
More horns.
Whereas we all know, you know, we've all lived with records, streams, CDs, records, whatever, in whatever era. And we all know this is the truth about long playing records. You do not know whether they're any good until 10 weeks later.
Yeah.
We had 10 weeks later. 10 weeks later, when something just comes on and you haven't even intended to put it on, and you go, yeah, you know, this is really good. And it's an accumulation of listeners. Is what teaches
those records that you lived with in an office when you were working on a music magazine. You played them every day and you suddenly realised how fantastic they were. We had that idea on Q that we were going to run a thing about records 6 months after they came out, going to reevaluate them and say, these are the ones that actually really, really went the distance. And these ones were a big disappointment.
Yeah.
They've been very valuable.
And you can tell, well, you don't even have to have something as formal as that. You can tell with record or with anything, whether people still talk about something 10 weeks later.
Yeah.
That's the real giveaway, you know what I mean? I've become fascinated by it, noticing when people don't talk about things. I think that's obviously off the boil. Nobody's talking about it anymore, whereas, you know, other things. And I was thinking about this, and the other thing with Bruce Springsteen, putting out Human Touch and Lucky Town on the same day, it can only have been because he wasn't really confident that either of them were quite up to scratch. Therefore, let's put out tons. You know, never mind the quality, feel the width kind of thing. You know what I mean?
But also, didn't he very cleverly suggest that one had a certain timbre about it and the other didn't? One was a sort of A-side record, one was a kind of B-side record. So therefore, you approach them with different expectations. But you're probably right. And that Beyoncé record, that's the key thing everyone picks up on. How long is it? 80 minutes.
It's 27 tracks.
27 tracks.
Now, nobody puts out 27 tracks if they're confident about them, I don't think. I think it's the opposite applies, actually, you know. You know, most, you know, how many double albums? I mean, I know that's not quite, it's probably the same. I mean, that's longer than Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, isn't it? Because Blonde on Blonde's not that long.
It's not that long, because Sad Eyed Lady is the whole side of a record. It's only about 12 minutes long.
Yeah. I mean, all double albums are longer than they need to be. Is that not the case? Surely.
Yeah, probably. But then you're very grateful for ones like, I think, ones like the White Album, because I think all the things that would never have made it onto a solo album, a single album, are actually really wonderful. All those little throwaway things.
That's the Beatles. You can't apply the standards.
Can't apply the Beatles. That's right.
For anybody else, really. But now I was thinking about Human Touch, Lucky Town, when I was reading all that stuff about Beyoncé this week. It's the same thing, you know. You've got a very limited amount of time to hear it, to arrive at some sort of judgment, and there's a huge amount of it. And therefore, the idea that your verdict will stand the test of time is, it's a pretty risky bet, it seems to me, but who cares?
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
It struck me this week that everything in entertainment nowadays, broad sweeping statement coming up, everything is simultaneously bigger and smaller. Now I can see you wrinkling, furrowing your brow. You're wondering what I could possibly mean by that.
No, I think I've got the gist of it.
And
you're talking about the huge, great entertainment series, aren't you?
Marvel. Not just that. I tell you, there's loads of things that made me think about this. I think we discussed this not long ago on the podcast. That the Arctic Monkeys were playing, whatever it was, it must have been last year at some time. I think they were playing two shows at the Arsenal Stadium.
Yeah.
And it's like the Arctic Monkeys are clearly enormously popular, but at the same time, not really very famous in the sense that I could walk past the Arctic Monkeys down my local high street and I wouldn't recognize them at all. Because
they exist entirely in a world for people who like the Arctic Monkeys. I'll tell you a really good example of that, Dua Lipa. When it was announced that Dua Lipa was headlining Glastonbury, did you follow this about a week ago?
Yes.
And a huge outcry from people who go to Glastonbury saying, she's headlining, I've never heard of her.
Oh,
No, but I thought that was really interesting because Dua Lipa, again, operates. Dua Lipa, I looked her up to see how many monthly streams she gets. The most, I think, at the moment is that just over 100 million a month is Taylor Swift, obviously. Well, Dua Lipa, I think, gets 77 million streams a month. She is absolutely massive.
Oh,
and yet,
of course.
And yet, you know, she can exist in a world where, unless you're interested in her, you may just be unaware that she's around. You know, if you look back to the old days of Top of the Pops or whatever, you were just, and also just mainstream radio, and you know, if there was a big hit, you heard it, didn't you? You heard it in cabs, you heard it in shops, you heard it on jukeboxes in pubs, You were just aware of its existence. But there are enormous acts now that the people outside their sphere have no notion of.
It's streaming does this, because you don't... Streaming means that fame is no longer enacted in the public space.
Yeah.
You don't see it occurring.
That's right.
You know, one of the measures of fame or popularity in the music space used to be you saw it enacted in places called record shops.
Yeah.
You went past the window of a record shop and it would be full of the new album by so-and-so. Or you go in and there'd be a pile of Robbie Williams CDs or whatever they were. You know, it was a visible process. There was, you know, going back to the days of Barry Norman and Jonathan Ross, film releases were, you know, on television. Oh, the new so-and-so is coming
up. You were aware of the films, even the ones that you weren't going to go and see.
Absolutely.
You knew something about it. You've seen the trailer or whatever.
Bookshops, all those kind of things. They were, you know, arenas where you saw this being acted out. You no longer do. And so all these things are going down phone lines or whatever. And your attention is only being drawn to how popular they've become when you get a thing like the Arctic Monkeys doing two nights at the Arsenal Stadium or whatever. And I'll tell you what was the classic case of this. And Alex in the background will desperately be trying to join us at this point. Is the Marvel film thing, you know, that whole world of Marvel films.
Which is completely black and white, isn't it? You're either in the deep end and know every detail of it, or you've absolutely no idea what anybody's talking about.
No, I don't talk. And it's never going to spread out of that, you know? It's, and you know, this is kind of, it's kind of silo culture, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And it's just the way we live now. So, you know, that's my theory for this week. Everything today is simultaneously bigger than you think and smaller than you imagined.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
A follow-up to that thing we were talking about last week about Phil Manzanera making more money than he made in Roxy Music out of 5 seconds of guitar playing in 1978, sitting on his sofa while watching the television. She's just such a great story all about him being sampled by Jay-Z and Kanye West. Just as a follow-up to that, Paul Jackson, and thanks very much for that, Paul, sent you, Dave, didn't
he? Yeah, I did.
A link to a story about a Scottish punk group called the Limps. It's just brilliant, and it's a story about how these guys who formed. It says in the piece, the Limps moved 20 miles south to Carlisle in the hope of cracking the big time, but fame never came. It's such a great way of writing. A group of aging punks have pogoed into the limelight.
This is from a Scottish newspaper, so the idea of we go to the bright lights of Carlisle in order to make our fortune, it's quite something. Carry on.
But they pogoed into the limelight after one of their songs was picked for a hit movie 45 years after it sold 50 copies. I love stories like this. So this group, the Limps, who consisted of Andy Septic, the drummer Derek, who was known as DDT, very good. Norman was Chuck Abnormal, and who was the bass player. I think the lead singer was Tam Limp. All bands had names like that, didn't they? Remember the Poison Girls were kind of, you know, Richard Famous, Lance DeBoyle, you know. Lance DeBoyle. Anyway, this track, one of their tracks, had sold 50 copies, had been picked up, a song called Someone I Can Talk To, and being used on the soundtrack of a coming-of-age comedy, Snack Shack, by the director Adam Reimer, I think it is. So I love stories like that. It's not an enormous amount of money, but suddenly, out of the blue, this little windfall appears 45 years later.
But as Phil Manzanera pointed out when we talked to him about all this a week or so ago, you've got to be still there, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's the reward you get for still being there when the phone call comes, you know. And I did like the picture of them from the paper, the four chaps with close-cropped hair, shall we say, in their 60s or possibly even their 70s, you know, sort of all old punk bands look like that, don't they?
They do, really gnarly.
Those, all those years later, you know, and one of them's a Labour councillor, you know, another one works in a library or whatever it was. You know.
We were talking to Paul Cook, weren't we, this week, the drummer of the Professionals
for the Sex Pistols.
And he was saying the same thing. He says, you know, they played all these old Pistols heads turn up now in their 60s, you know, and with their fading tattoos. Brilliant.
I was looking at Bruce Springsteen resumed his tour, didn't he, this week in the United States. And, of course, there is footage of absolutely everything nowadays. Then it used to be. It used to be a complete blackout on seeing what those things looked like or sounded like. But nowadays, everybody's got a mobile phone out. And so there are the Bruce Springsteen, the E String Band, on stage. Strangely enough, none of them with grey hair, as far as I can see.
No,
and they're looking out on a sea of people, fans, all of whom have grey hair. You know, it must be kind of an odd sight. You know, if you're on stage, you know that, you know, like we always say that when you get old, you always think, "Oh, I'm still 24," but even though you know you're not, you know, but kind of people in rock bands sort of have to go on stage and sort of pretend that they are 24. Don't they really? Even in the teeth of considerable evidence to the contrary.
Well, they do, and their counter argument for why they dye their hair, if indeed they do dye their hair, is that from the distance on stage they still look like themselves. It's what McCartney also used to say. He says, "When I've got a collarless jacket on,
yeah,
I got my dark hair, I still look like Paul McCartney from 1965. If you're a quarter of a mile away."
Of course, one thing you can guarantee is nowadays that people looking are looking from further and further away, aren't they? All the time. It's a fact. Talking of age, so you were talking about Tony Blackburn. Tony Blackburn, what is he, 81?
81. He's 81. No, he just retired from, after I think 43 years of doing local radio. He's still doing radio too.
Because he hasn't got time. He hasn't got time.
He hasn't got time to do local radio. He's too busy. I've got to admit, I love Tony Blackburn. I'm sorry, I do. I think he's absolutely fantastic. And you think of all those years of that kind of Arnold and bad jokes and the cheesy disco and all that stuff that stigma that was attached to him. You know, he's kind of come out the other side of that now and is genuinely recognised as a fantastically influential figure. Don't you think?
Oh,
I mean, well, amazing. He was playing all that Tamla Motown and all that soul and stuff on national radio at a time when everybody else was desperately trying to play, I don't know what it would have been.
The Skids.
The Mud. The Skids, probably, yeah.
And it's interesting if you look back, and when I was writing my book about 1971, Bowie put out Hunky Dory, which did nothing at all, didn't chart. But Oh You Pretty Thing was, it got very little radio exposure, but it was Tony Blackburn's record of the week. And that was in the days when that meant something, because the audience for Tony Blackburn would be considerable. I think when, you know, all the hype has died down, he's been the greatest British DJ for pretty much all his professional career, for this simple reason, that when he plays a record, he plays a record because he likes it.
Yeah, he likes it.
And that does not apply to the overwhelming majority of DJs. Yeah. And because they play things because the producers told them to, or because they played the last one, or because they think it'll make them popular, or because they think it'll make them hip, or they play it because somebody else is playing it. All those motivations come into it. Tony Blackburn's not doing that.
No, I agree. And also, I think you have to point out that it was more challenging. It was much braver in his case to play these kind of fringe-ish records because he's playing them on national radio. I mean, John Peel, obviously, fantastic achievement. Everyone goes how wonderful it was that he gave all these people airplay. But he gave them airplay in the context of a program that went on at 10 o'clock at night till midnight.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was expressly set up to try out experimental music that would never, you know, to challenge you, which would never have been played in the daytime anyway.
Yeah.
So I do think he deserves some credit for that.
But whenever I see him on social media, in the middle of winter, if you wake up early and you go downstairs to make a cup of tea or whatever, and it's cold, and you put on your phone and you look on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, and you notice that Tony Blackburn has just posted a little clip of him arriving outside Broadcasting House or Wogan House or wherever in order to just go in and do his program. It's perishing bloody cold. Yeah. He's 81 years old. He's driven up from wherever he lives.
Yeah.
And he's so bothered about doing it that he records a little thing to his phone saying, do join me in an hour's time.
Or
whatever. It's fantastic energy to keep on doing that. So, you know, more power to you.
Yeah, on his 80th birthday, I remember he posted a thing saying he'd said something like, I've just come back from a 6-mile run. I'm going to have a big family meal. And then later on, we got tennis, I think it was. And I just thought, that is just great.
That's the way to go on.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
I noticed that today, we're recording this March the 30th. Today is the anniversary. This is a significant event. In 1978, of Paul Simon and Nicky Hedden of The Clash being arrested in Camden Town after shooting racing pigeons with air guns on the roof of their Chalk Farm studios. Do you remember that, Dave? It's fantastic. I'm just looking at a little version of it here. It says, 4 police cars and a helicopter are required to make their arrest. That clearly didn't happen. Their fines totaled £800. I love that, because I just made me miss the fact that the music press at that time was there were lots of staple stories that just ran and ran and became
Have you gone back and looked at that story? Because I remember this running for a while in the weekly music press.
Yeah.
And probably not anywhere else at all. But anyway, the weekly music press. I don't recall, I may be wrong, but I do not recall at any point in the coverage of that story, either in the coverage or in the response of the letter page, I do not recall anyone saying, isn't that a bit cruel to the pigeons? Do you recall any of that?
No, well, they would now, wouldn't they? They'd be an absolute outcry if indeed any of it actually happened.
That's the first thing
anyone would say.
That's the very first thing anyone would say. And, you know, it's inconceivable that within a few days, they wouldn't have had to issue a public apology. They just would.
They would.
Now, I'm going to put this to you, Mark. The Clash, if they issue a public apology for anything, are no longer The Clash. The whole deal about The Clash was, we're rebels. We just don't care, you know. That's what we're here for. That's what we represent. That's why people still revere them. However many years, 45 years later, it's all about those kind of rebel values.
So they wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes now.
They'd be dead.
The truth.
That's why.
I know.
That's why you go through, you go through all those acts who are appearing at this year's Glastonbury. Where are the rebels? There aren't any. They've just left. They've left the building. They've been forced to leave the building by attitude of public censoriousness.
But if you look back at that time when I was at the NME, there were various big characters. Bob Geldof was one of them. Bob Geldof, whatever Bob Geldof did, whatever he said was quotable, and he was never out of the papers. He was just really good value and really good copy. Boy George, a bit later on.
Fantastic,
wasn't he? Boy George was the character that went from the music press actually into the kind of into the mainstream press.
Fleet Street,
that was the person that made them realise that they all had to get pop columns and have daily coverage of pop.
He was the crossover artist.
Boy George, wandering about, you know, saying that he liked sex, but he preferred a cup of tea.
Whatever he said,
the pantomime dame, you know. And I just, it's interesting because there are no characters like that anymore. And part of the reason for that is that nobody dares be outspoken
about anything.
Because if you were, whatever Boy George said now about the thing about sex or the cup of tea or whatever, somebody would find some angle and stir up some kind of lobby that would make life difficult for him. And as you say, you'd spend your entire time being forced to apologise, which just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work at all. Now, it's interesting when you think back on these stories. And the one I think you're remembering was when, was it John Mackay and Kenny Morris?
Oh, yeah.
decamped from the Banshees.
They left the Banshees. They stuffed their pillowcases full of clothes, supposedly, and left kind of what appeared to be their sleeping bodies in the beds, climbed out a back window and left the tour. I mean, I remember that running for ages. I remember the story about Jazz Coleman, A Killing Joke, disappearing to Iceland, do you remember, to escape the apocalypse.
Yes,
obviously, there was some other agenda going on. But, you know, those stories just ran and ran and ran.
Yeah.
Kevin Rowland at one point stole the master tapes to, what was it, Don't Stand
Oh,
Gallery.
God, yes.
And, well, he tried to steal the master tapes and completely bungled it. Had a limo waiting outside, but when he ran out with the master tapes under his donkey jacket, the guy driving, the chauffeur, had actually gone off to make a phone call or something and left the car locked. But I remember those things as being really, really exciting. And later on, there was a fire at Phonogram when they thought that the master tapes had been destroyed. I mean, I'm sure very little of this actually happened. It's just
absolutely.
You miss those things.
Didn't Judas Priest supposedly have the tapes that there are one of their
albums? They might have done.
Kidnapped.
They might have done. Yeah.
You know, they're ransomed to be returned. This is the way that PRs used to just get stories in the music press, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that was the important thing to do in the weeks leading up to the release of an album.
And the other great engine was that kind of divide and rule thing, wasn't it? Is to pitch two acts against each other. Cliff versus Elvis, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Beatles, Stones. Hendrix, Clapton.
Yes.
Bowie v. Bolan. Clash v Pistols.
Yes, Genesis.
Yes, and Genesis. Yeah, Clash versus, yeah, then Spandau Ballet versus Duran Duran.
Of course.
Against Blur.
Of course.
Spans, and do you remember they were on a special edition of Pop Quiz with Mike
Reed? Yes, they were.
It was such a big deal, wasn't it? Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran together.
God,
in the same
you had
room.
Forgotten that, yes.
Yeah.
My goodness. Are there still rivalries of that kind?
Well, there
probably are, because there's no music press to gin them up in the first place.
It's entirely cooked up by the music press.
Yeah.
For obvious commercial reasons. Oh, I miss all that.
Yeah, I miss those, because the great thing about those stories is they didn't matter at all.
No, remotely.
Absolutely neither here nor there. Whereas the occasional, you know, whenever the music gets into the so-called mainstream media nowadays, it's career-ending stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, really? It's P. Diddy, isn't it?
It's
a terrible story, but, you know, it only works if it can be measured by the kind of metric of the mainstream press, which is mostly statistics. People get in there because they've broken some record.
Oh,
they have made more money. They have sold more tickets.
It.
That's so
I
bad.
Refuse to read
because
these.
They have changed the economy of Northern Ireland by playing two concerts at the sunset. You think, oh, this is ludicrous, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Or because it's a diversity issue about, you know, whether they should or shouldn't be playing, you know, Glastonbury, whatever. So, yeah, what we miss is the simple days where people
the days when you could go
building
up
with an air gun and killed a load of innocent birds and nobody minded.
And with that, we'll take a break.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Okay, we're joined by our birthday guest, Andrew Newbury. Andrew, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very good. When was the birthday?
Maundy Thursday.
Okay. Were there celebrations?
Hey, it was good. It was a pub lunch, some fine wine, watched a couple of my favourite films. A very nice way to spend the day.
So what is the conversational log you wish to throw on the Word in Your Ear fire this week?
Okay. Well, this is partly inspired by your conversation a couple of podcasts ago about divorce lyrics and divorce songs, and I wondered, are musical genres tied into lyrical stereotypes? So, for example, you know, country music seems to be dominated by the three Ds, drinking, dogs and divorce. Rap music is guns, money and hoes.
That's true.
You know, prog is goblins and the moons of Uranus. So I was just wondering, you know, would people feel uncomfortable if certain music fell outside of those stereotypes?
I mean, I think it's an interesting point, because I think in defense of country music is about everything, absolutely anything. But every country music song has to have a story. And they generally start with the title. If you don't, you know, the people who worked in the kind of songwriting mills of Nashville were legendarily guys who sat in a bar at lunchtime and then wrote down things that people said that they overheard on cocktail napkins, and then went away and wrote songs based on them. And I think that still holds true, because you expect the audience to be able to recognize their life in the song.
Whereas it's a mirror to your own life.
It is. It's supposed to be a mirror to human life. And the thing that always amazes me about most popular music is how little it kind of reflects the things that people are talking about nowadays, because most of it's written by kind of anonymous professionals, it seems to me. You know, that, I don't know, you know, the gender debate. Has that popped up in a popular song recently? Maybe it has and I've missed it, you know. But also, you know, you're quite right that prog, you know, tends to write about kind of abstract things that are considered slightly sort of too difficult to be in a basic pop song. Isn't that the case, Mark? Is that what it seems to happen?
I think so. And I think a lot has to do with the fact that prog, if this isn't too wild a generalisation, was actually kind of started by quite middle-class and bookish people. I think significant tracks were things like Piper at the Gates of Dawn, the title of that album.
Yeah, the very idea.
Which, the idea that you associated with that kind of music with childish escapist literature, and then Set the Controls to the Heart of the Sun, which was about kind of space travel, and that then went sideways into sci-fi with Yes and groups like that. Mm. I think that was the basic foundation, that kind of music was associated with imaginative thought processes and escape. I don't know if it's about that now, because I don't know enough about it, but that's certainly how it started off.
My wife rather undermined this yesterday when I was telling her about what I'd be talking to you two about. And my wife loves prog. She's one of the few women, she loves prog more than I do. And she said, well, didn't King Crimson do a song about cat food?
They did.
That defeats your theory.
Well, okay, but that was, to be fair, very much the exception that proves the rule. In the world of King Crimson, who, don't forget, their first album was called In the Court of the Crimson King, An Observation by King Crimson.
Yeah,
an observation.
Danny Baker likes to point out.
Yes.
So we got Alex here with us. Alex.
Yes.
What are the indie songwriting cliches? You know, because you're the official representative of indie on Earth.
Indie correspondent, yes. Well, actually, weirdly enough, I was thinking about this the other day, because they seem to have disappeared, but certainly in the noughties, which you could argue was, Landville Indie's peak, it was escaping the 95 and the drudgery of the man. Anything that evoked getting out of the drudgery of having a normal job was...
It was about suburbia too, wasn't it?
Yeah. I suppose the mundanity of small town life, living in Staines, things like that. That was... that's your indie trope remit. But I'm not sure that exists anymore, because I think everybody's a bit more outward facing these days.
Yeah. Oasis were all about escapism, though, weren't they? The sort of celebration of being together. So the Oasis songs were kind of about Oasis.
They were. They were.
To be in Oasis.
Absolutely.
About having it large.
They were about celebrating. And that's quite interesting you should say that, because they were the group who, huge part of their success was that their audiences could sing along. They could kind of identify. Yeah. Live Forever and all that kind of stuff, you know. Whereas the same thing wouldn't apply to Blur, would it, Alex? I don't think it would it?
Blur were too clever for that. But the Oasis, what Noel managed to do at in his prime was perfectly marry euphoria and melancholy. Like all those early songs are obviously hugely anthemic and make people feel really, really good, like they're really alive. But there's a hint of yearning that underpins them all. I find, especially when he sings them as well, they're kind of transformed by Liam's voice and his tone and his general persona. But when Noel grabbed the mic in the early days, at least, it felt like he was giving the songs a sort of a more melancholy voicing. And, you know, that aspect of them was brought to the forefront in a way that Liam
somebody
did.
Wrote a brilliant piece about them for The Word and described them as a rock and soul band, which I thought was really good, actually. Mm. Oasis, because they're a rock band, but they also had a real sort of, certainly Noel's element of it was deep and faintly philosophical.
Yeah, but I do think it's interesting to contrast this with something we were talking about earlier, the Beyonce mega hit at the moment, which is a brilliant record. It's not about anything at all. Not for a second. It doesn't make any sense. It never tries to make any sense at all. It's a brilliant record. It's just a brilliant piece of record making. You know? Nobody is sitting there listening to it thinking, that's my life. You know, I need to have that record.
Mind you, you could say that about Bob Dylan as well, couldn't you? A lot of his songs didn't make a lot of sense. They just sounded good.
That's a fair point.
Consciousness is a thing. The thing with Beyonce's new record, it probably doesn't make sense as a whole because it is written by committee. And I think the thing with modern songwriting is that it's a load of different bits bolted together, essentially. Yeah. Saying, you know, so while it might, you know, it's a fantastic record, but it doesn't have the same, perhaps have the same depth that something written by a singular entity would.
No,
the same stream of consciousness.
You couldn't sit down and play it on a guitar or a piano or whatever. I don't think it could be done.
But the Dylan records did take you on a... I know what you mean about the mid-60s ones, but they did take you on an imaginative adventure. So you could they did inspire you to think of things. But I think Dave's point about Beyonce is you're not quite sure what it is you're meant to be thinking about.
Mm. Yeah. Well, food for thought there, Andrew. Food for thought, and I'm sure other people may have their points of view, which they might like to share with us in future weeks. And we just wanted to close by talking about stag do's, because Alex has got to organise one, and we think Alex is a very unlikely person to be organising a stag do, being the kind of senior vegan. And you know, how's it going, Alex?
It's going well. We're booking a spa day and going to a juice bar. Booked tickets to a club where ladies put clothes on.
Oh dear! Well, I'm so glad to see that tradition continues. So,
there's no paintball. There's no bowling. There's none of that. It's just
I've done paintballing before.
Eating fake on sandwiches.
Well, I'm trying to avoid all the classic staggy things. So yeah, paintball's off the menu. Might do something involving climbing and trees. That's on the B list of things to organise at the moment. But it's going to be quite a genteel thing. We're a bit too old to be having it too large these days. But I'm deadly serious about the spa day. That is actually going to happen.
Our stag party's still
a
thing.
Really excited about it. Yeah, they are.
It's still a thing on it because about 10 years ago, they're a massive thing.
They're not.
My eldest son would be going on things for 3 days. You go to Prague dressed as a penguin.
Yeah, you go to Magaluf or something like that.
Yeah,
you
know. Magaluf. And then even more terrifying, I don't know if any of you have been on there, had the experience of getting on an easy jet to discover that sitting three rows in front of you is a hen party.
Oh, my God.
Girls in pink T-shirts, white cowboy hats and dealy boppers.
A friend of mine was covered in green dye all over his body at his stag do, and he had quite a serious job in the city. So on the Monday morning, he was wearing his suit and shirt and tie, and underneath he was entirely green. He managed to get it off his hat and his face.
That's great. Well, I'd like to say happy days, but I don't miss them at all.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.